This week on Pop of Culture, we break glass.
I like to think of glass as like a spicy puzzle.
We learn about the art of stained glass.
We also get the story behind a returning musician's latest single.
And this song is basically about like how I just want to hang out on my couch in my sweatpants and drink wine.
We'll ask another artist, what are you working on?
And we'll have this week's arts calendar. All of that and more coming up.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
From IPR, this is Pop of Culture, outside and loving every minute of it. I'm Michelle Kinsey.
It's a beautiful day, and I'm Kara Duquette. Coming up, we'll hear a new single from an artist who's committing to country.
But first, we're going to look into the medium of stained glass.
Erica Markley is a stained glass artist and the owner of Markley Farms Glassworks. She also teaches glass at Mad Jack's. And we're very happy to have you here today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Specifically, let's get started by asking you, what are you working on right now?
Right now, I'm working on market prep. I have two big markets coming up. May 3rd is the Muncie Mama's Market. It's a market geared toward moms and their children. So I'm making a lot of book night lights that you could put in a nursery or a child's room, some snail, mushroom, planter sticks that go in your house plants, some just kind of cutesy pieces of glass. And then May 10th, I'll be at Minnetrista's Garden Fair. And there I'm doing a build your own bouquet stand. I have made 236 individual flowers and greenery, and you can just come through and just pick whatever you like and build your own little bouquet, and then it'll last forever.
Well, that's very interesting. All of the things you've mentioned might not be the first thing someone thinks about when they think about stained glass.
Sure, yeah.
So how did you find stained glass? How did you get into it?
Grief.
Okay.
My dog died in July of 2021. And a couple months after his passing, I was scrolling through Pinterest and I saw this Dachshund stained glass. And I was like, oh my gosh, I have to make that. So my husband had bought me a beginner stained glass kit in 2015, I think. But I just never got into it. Even though I've loved stained glass forever, but we just never had enough time leaving the army, having to stay with my mother-in-law, starting a farm. Like, it just never felt right. And then I saw that stained glass Dachshund and I was like, oh my gosh, I have to make that for him. So I went upstairs and I grabbed the kit and I took it to the garage and I cut all the pieces and it was awful. It turned out awful. Like, it would not fit together right. So I had to switch it up and glue it to clear glass, and then I grouted it. So my first piece actually turned out to be a mosaic style instead of actual stained glass. But that got me in the kit, and it just kind of lit that fire. And I was just like, oh my gosh, I love this so much. And now here I am 4 years later talking to you about it. So
that's pretty incredible. You kind of never know where the artistic inspiration will come from.
Yeah.
Well, I have to know, what was your Dachshund's name?
He was named Marshall.
Marshall.
Yeah.
So Marshall started it all.
Marshall started it all. Yeah. He was a miniature long-haired Dachshund. He was the best.
Well, I can relate. I have a Chiweenie.
Aww.
And he's very, very old.
Yeah.
His name's Teddy.
Oh, I love it.
I want to know, as you talk about your first foray into stained glass, you talked about cutting the pieces and putting them together and how you turned it into a mosaic, which was a different way to create stained glass. Well, a mosaic piece. Can you talk a little more about the process? Because I don't know how much we all know about that.
Sure. So I like to think of glass as like a spicy puzzle. So you have a pattern and you have to cut your glass to fit that pattern, because if your glass pieces don't fit together properly, then you can't solder it together. Like, it won't last. So when you're cutting, you just have to make sure that you're staying in that pattern. And then you have a grinder. If you've cut too large, that you just kind of grind it down until it fits together like a puzzle. And then you you clean it really well, because there's a copper foil tape that you put on afterward, and it's sticky. And you wrap it around the edges of the glass, and then you take a fiddlestick and you rub it. You rub the tops of the glass, and then you rub the sides of the glass, and then you stick it together, and then you flux it. And then you take your soldering iron and your lead solder, and you just solder it together. So it's just a big spicy puzzle, which my thumbs, and I had one piece just fly off the grinder the other day, and it stabbed me right in my thumb pad.
Oh.
And it just hurts. It won't stop bleeding.
Well, I hope it heals soon.
Thank you.
So when you're talking about the fluxing, what's fluxing specifically?
So flux is it can be a liquid, a gel, or a paste. And okay. It's a chemical that moves the solder. So you have to have flux on your piece for the solder to melt properly.
Okay.
If you don't have enough flux or any flux at all, it'll just kind of be gloopy, and you won't get that nice smooth bead like you are used to seeing on a piece of stained glass. So the flux is there to help the solder move.
Okay. So have you found over time that you enjoy making flat pieces more or sculptural pieces?
I do a little bit of both. I do make three-dimensional pieces. I make votive holders. So I have to cut a bunch of square pieces of glass. And I like to do a pressed flower in between two pieces of clear. And then that'll be like the front part of the votive. Putting those together are a little bit tricky. They can be a little tedious, but they are fun. And then I make these little birds out of scrap pieces, which are fun to make. And you add the legs, and so three-dimensional is pretty fun.
Can you go into a little more detail about one of your birds? That sounds interesting.
Well, I go through my scrap pile, and I look for pieces that look bird shape. And then I go and I try to find triangular pieces for their beaks, and then I just put them together.
So you're using a lot of different colors in your images?
Yeah. I seem to have a lot of green. I was looking through my shelf the other day, and there's lots of green and lots of purple. But yeah.
Well, you were talking about patterns and the dachshund that began it all. Do you also draw patterns?
I do. When I first started out, I would buy patterns from other artists, or I would try to make my own, and there's a skill to making a pattern that you can actually cut the glass for. So glass likes to run straight across. If you have too big of a dip in your pattern, your glass probably won't break that way, and you'll waste a lot of glass. So there definitely is a skill to pattern making. I have practiced a lot, and I have started to make my own patterns. But I do occasionally still buy from artist friends that have one. I was like, oh, that's super cute. I need that. But...
Well, and when you're crafting someone else's image, it's still, you know, you're collaborating then, right?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes my brain is just like, oh, I can't right now. I need to make something, but I just need it to be easy. So I'm just going to buy this, and I'm just going to make this, and I don't have to do that extra step of creating that pattern.
Now, when you talk about cutting the glass pieces, do you have multiple tools to do that, or?
So you use a scoring tool, and you set your glass on your pattern, and you trace it out with a Sharpie. And then you take your scoring tool and you run the line, And then you have running pliers, which are good for straight breaks. And then you have grousing pliers, which are good for pulling small pieces of glass apart. And then you have another tool, and I'm going to botch the name. It's Silberschnitz. And it's also a running plier, but the head is movable. So when you're running a line, especially in a deep curve, you can position that head to follow the score line, and it can you can get a deep curve out of that. It takes skill and practice, but that tool has it's invaluable.
That sounds really interesting. So there's never really a point where you're cutting completely through. You're just scoring.
And then I break it and with pliers.
Wow.
Or my hands.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hence the injury.
Hence the injuries, yes.
So do you ever take commissions from people who are interested in?
I do. People will come to me at the farmer. I'm a vendor at the Minnetrista Farmers Market. And they're always like, do you take commissions? And I'm like, yeah. And then we'll sit there and we'll chat about their idea, and I'll give them my email and we'll just email back and forth. And
well, I ask you that because you're talking about, you know, shapes and how, you know, you can't go too far with certain aspects of the glass shaping.
Yes.
So I just wonder, is there a lot of back and forth with that?
There is. So you can have people that they want everything under the sun and you're like, I can't really do that in the glass. I'm sorry. Like, I don't have a kiln. If I had a kiln and I could fuse some pieces, you could take that and incorporate that into a panel that you wouldn't have to cut. So like eyes, for instance. So let's say you wanted like two big round eyes, like a Garfield face or something. Like, it would be a lot easier to just take those, the forehead of Garfield and then two eyeballs and kiln fire that and fuse it together and then add that piece into a traditional stained glass piece. I've seen a lot of artists do that, which is really cool. But yeah, it can be a lot of back and forth of, hey, this isn't going to work in the pattern. I can't make glass cut that way. Or you can with a saw, but the piece can end up being unstable.
Mm. Now, do you have a lot of different types of glass that you work with?
There's a lot of texture. Mm. So there's different textures that, like, when it's made and it's rolled, they can roll it a certain way. They can add dots inside of it. So a piece of glass can look like rain. Or there's something called glue chip, which it looks like a wintered frosted window. And they make that by gluing horsehair to clear glass. And then they put it in a kiln and the hair burns away, but it leaves that texture on top of the glass. And it looks like a frosted winter window. And it's really cool.
And that's excellent. You can use that technique with pottery, too. So I had no idea you could do that with glass.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you so much for chatting with us
Thanks.
Today.
Thanks. It was fun.
Erica Markley is the owner of Markley Farms Glassworks. Put on our cowboy hats for this next segment as we check in with a familiar voice. We would like to welcome back Dana Powell. Dana, as many of you will remember, is a singer-songwriter originally from Canada, now living in East Central Indiana. So thank you for coming here again today.
Thank you so much for having me on again.
Of course. When we last spoke, you were dropping an album, Your Love Is Enough. And today we want to know, what are you working on now?
So I'm working on a whole new album.
Ooh, excellent.
Yeah. So my new single came out a couple weeks ago. It's been on the Midwest Country Music Original Show now for 4 weeks in a row. And so playing on 28 commercial stations across the Midwest, which was really exciting. So the producer that produced that single is actually producing an entire album for me right now. So I am very, we talked about producers last time and how I am not one.
So you found one.
Well, you know, and it's so crazy because we actually have known each other for like 10 years. I didn't know he lived in Indiana, right, before. And So we connected on Facebook and I was like, you live here and you have a studio here? And this is crazy, right? So we just like instantly reconnected, and he's absolutely amazing. He's in Fort Wayne. So that's what we're doing now.
What's your single title?
It's Where Would We Be?
Where Would We Be? Mm-hmm. And so what was your vision for this album? And what is the album title as well?
Yeah. I'm not sure what the album title is going to be yet. The vision for it is to be more fun, more energetic, more just like, it's definitely more country. Because the last stuff I've done is pretty crossover, pretty like AC and pop and country mixed together. And this is going to be pretty much just country.
Oh, yeah. We did talk about genres last time. And I want to know, does this album relate to the last one in some ways?
Yeah, for sure. It's a lot about, okay, so we're going to release a single for the summer, which I'm super excited about because it's like a fun song. So I write a lot of songs about like love, relationships, and all this kind of stuff. And this song is basically about like how I just want to hang out on my couch in my sweatpants and drink wine.
Outside, maybe.
Yeah, outside. I mean, wherever I'm, and not, you know, put on tons of makeup every day and like all the things that I kind of did when I was in my 20s, and now I'm in like a different stage of life. And I feel like a lot of people can probably relate to that. My friends sure can. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. And I said outside because it could be the song of the summer.
Oh, yeah.
And Muncie has a lot of couches outside.
Really?
It does.
There you go. Sitting on the couch outside in Muncie and have some wine and
listen to your song.
Yeah, I think it's gonna be fun.
So we're talking about music, and like not every artist is making an album. So just the fact that you're conceiving of it as an album.
Yeah, I was actually talking to the producer about this last week. I asked him, how many albums are you working on right now? And he said, only yours. And I was like shocked most artists are doing singles. Maybe some EPs, but mostly singles. And I'm like, so why is that?
Right.
What do you think?
I think it has something to do with the pace of society now and the fact that we were talking about, like, you know, the top 150, how many musicians you have access to all the time. You know, it's just, I don't know. If
there's so many. Right. So maybe it's like, I mean, there's so many artists right now, especially with Spotify streaming, right? Mm-hmm. And TikTok and Instagram, and you want to get that one song out and go viral, and then that's your hook, right? So I can see the draw for sure, but I think it's when I was talking to Carl is the producer, talking to Carl about this, he was saying artists really should focus on like a body of work, you know, put some time into like writing the lyrics for a whole album and putting the work into the whole album, making it cohesive, like sonically cohesive, and like making it that piece of art that you really are doing this, you know, while you're doing this in the first place, and give people. So it's interesting. And I put out singles too. I mean, I'm not against singles at all. I'm just saying like that is an interesting change that's happened.
Oh yeah. And hey, Carl, not everybody has Carl to think about, you know, their musical craft with, you know, like a lot of people have access more so than they did in the past, like mm-hmm. to put something out into the world.
Oh, that's for sure.
So
yeah, everyone, I mean, you can, my mom actually like sang a song recently and I put it on Spotify for her. I was like, yeah, like you have all the access, but if you can find some producer that can bring and I know it's expensive, it gets costly, right? But even if you're going to do a single, just like bring your song to life. I mean, that is a difference between writing your song and recording it and having kind of, you know, like that live music stripped down sound, or like really taking that song and having someone make it come alive. There is a difference there. And it is amazing.
Yeah, like it's a collaboration on so many different levels.
Mm-hmm. It's a collaboration. And yeah, right. You have someone else's brain power and input, right, that on your song. And there's also that thing where you hear something too many times and you've listened to it for so many hours that you like can't even hear it properly anymore, right? So then you have someone else to come in with fresh ears and be like, okay, that's weird. That's not right.
Well, so the album's completely written. Okay.
I finished writing it last night.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Fresh out of your mind, under the paper. Well, so do you have a favorite song that you're gravitating
You know,
towards?
I actually really do like the songs, I'm biased, aren't I? well, the one that we're going to do as a single, I really like it because it's just super honest, you know. I've written a few songs for my husband. And I was joking with him last night. I was like, okay, all these songs are just like about you. I mean, it's basically your album. Maybe we just put your face on the album cover. Jokes, but.
But like, okay, they're about your husband. What, different aspects? Your love, what are they about?
Yeah, different. I mean, one of the songs, he hasn't actually, I don't want him to hear them yet because I want it to be a surprise. But one of the songs is about, because, you know, I moved from like a big city to the middle of Indiana, right? So I a lot in interviews are like, what? You did what? And but so one of the songs is about just that, like moving from a city to the country and what I left in the city and now what I'm for in the country, right? So like the song is all about that. It's actually called Home is the Country because that it's going to be like, if home's where the heart is, then home is the country.
Yeah. And well, do you feel inspired by your new surroundings?
Yeah, I do. And it took some time. I got to say, it's a big change to come from, you know, to move over. But now it's like, I mean, it's peaceful. It's quiet. It's like open space. It's like, it's the sunsets, right? Like I never had sunsets growing up because we lived in the mountains and it was just different. You're stuck in rush hour. It would take me like an hour and 20 minutes sometimes to get to work when I, you know, when there's no traffic, it was 15 minutes.
I don't miss that at all. That reminds me of Chicago.
Right.
The intense traffic where you're like, okay, I have to have a project. Yeah,
I mean, that's actually really saves a lot of time, right? In your life, it's like not sitting in traffic for 2 hours a day.
There's something to be said for that, the reclaimed time. Mm-hmm. Excellent. I'm excited to hear it. Sounds like it's full of serotonin. Your last album was beautiful and it was very, made me feel introspective. And
oh,
you know.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. I feel like it was a lot more, maybe not slower, but like lots of ballads and lots of emotion happening, right? And I want the one that's coming up to be a bit more like fun and energizing and like getting, you know, getting out and being happy kind of thing. Yeah.
That sounds really good. Well, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Dana Powell is a songwriter and musician based in Indiana. This is her new single, Where Would We Be?
You can watch the sunset when you're disappointed. You don't have to drive yourself insane. You can count your blessings instead of second guessing. We've all been there and made mistakes. Take a breath, calm the voice that says, this isn't meant for me. Cause in the end, you have no choice. So dive in, count on one, two, three. Where would we be?
Chasing when they called us crazy. Where would we be?
fell down, if every little thing became a mountain too high, we wouldn't dare climb. Where would we be now? Where would we be if we kept quiet when we should be loud?
This is Pop of Culture. I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey. Last Saturday was Independent Bookstore Day, and that reminded us of our interview with Ray Peterson.
Along with being a retired professor, Indiana artisan, and paper artist, Ray is a bookbinder. We started by asking her how she got into hand-binding books.
Yeah, so I love paper. I love all kinds of paper, but I particularly love hand-marbled papers from around the world. And, you know, a piece of hand-marbled paper costs around in the neighborhood of $35. So what can you do with it if you have a piece of beautiful paper? You could wrap a gift in it, and you could cringe when the recipient just tore it open violently, right? Or you could make something out of it that you could carry with you. And I like hand-marbled paper so much that I think of it as a kind of a comfort. And so I like having it with me. And so I put it on books, and then I can carry it to meetings, et cetera.
Wow. When you talk about hand-marbled paper, I have many different papers in my head. I have made paper out of dryer lint, actually, in the past. But for you, are you talking about a specific type of marbling or a specific process?
Making paper and marbling paper, right, are totally separate. I've made paper too, but not very successfully because it tends to be lumpy and gray and curly and that kind of thing. Hand marbling I've also done, but I really, in my business, I leave that to the experts. Quickly, and you can see this on YouTube all the time, you take paper, you treat it with alum to make it receptive to ink. And then you float ink or thinned paint on thickened water, and you draw in it with tools that look like combs. And then you float the paper on it and transfer that ink onto the paper.
Beautiful. That sounds very similar to, marbling scarves and other fabrics.
Yeah, it is, actually.
Okay. I want to know, beyond the papers inspiring you, which is amazing. What else has inspired you to make books?
I think really just I like books a lot. I mean, I'm a former literature professor. And also in my career, my publisher Parrish line of work was in biography. And so I know the paper that lasts is of enormous interest to people, and not necessarily the paper that you think. I mean, private letters are great, handwritten diaries are great, but like I would jump for joy when I found someone's check register, right? Because like the most mundane pieces of paper, recipes, family notes, that sort of thing, a check register, it tells where people got their money and how they spent their money. And that's the story of their life right there.
Yeah.
Well, add to it who they loved and who they slept with, and there you've got it all, right? So I think that I want paper to last. And so the books I build are all 100% archival, which means acid-free materials that are capable of lasting at least 400 years. And, you know, sometimes people say, well, what am I going to write that's going to be of interest in 400 years? And I think, do we not live in the most interesting time in our lifetime right now? We're just briefly post-COVID, and we're living in a politically tumultuous time. And in the past week, an airplane has fallen out of the sky every day. Like, if that's not going to be interesting to people in the future, I really don't. They're going to have some incredible entertainment.
Oh, for sure. It's like you just, even when you write anything and then you look at it when you're not in it, you know, in a year or 10 years or, you know, a whole another generation, it just has a different appeal, you know, than possibly when you're in it.
Exactly. Here's a bit of heresy. I don't keep a daily journal. I'm not really that interested in what I ate for breakfast. But when I travel, I always keep a daily journal. And no matter how late I get in or how exhausted I am, I find time to write 3 or 4 pages every day when I'm away from home. And I think that my goal for that is that when I'm in a nursing home, someone in my family will have to read those to me and convince me I had an interesting life.
Well, that is something to look forward to. Can I ask you, what are you working on right now, Ray?
Well, right now I'm in just a really high production mode. I have, I do commissions. I build books, you know, that people ask me to build for them. And then I also, as an Indiana artisan, I sell work through the store and I participate in the Indiana Artisan Marketplace, which is coming up the last week of March on the weekend on Saturday and Sunday at the Indiana State Fairgrounds. And so right now I'm building inventory for that. And so it's kind of fun. I have, in my shop, I have a lot of flat files and they're full of beautiful papers and the medallions, the talismans that I put in the covers of books. And I get to kind of browse around and shop and put together combinations I like and then build those books.
Okay. So you talk about the talisman. Where does that come from? When did you start doing that?
Well, it started, I had this marvelous job. Because I studied women who lived in Paris between the wars, I got to go to Paris a lot. Uh-huh. And while I was in Paris, here's the thing, I think in the 19th century, the French probably gave a bronze medal to everybody for everything. And so in flea markets and coin shops, et cetera, around Paris, you can find these incredibly sculpted bas-relief little medallions, maybe 2-3 inches across. And I really loved them. I started collecting them, and I knew about treasure bindings, which are, when people were illiterate, binders sometimes put gemstones and gold and valuable things on the covers of books to communicate that books were things of value. And so I thought, you know what I want to do? I want to bring back treasure binding in a way that's compatible with modern bookshelves, because when you build a book now, it has to be able to be forced into an overstuffed bookshelf because, you know, in the current time, people can own more books than are really good for them. So I started putting those medals and medallions I found in France in the covers of books as good luck charms. And I kind of thought at first that that was my little peccadillo and nobody would be interested in it. But when I started doing markets and shows, I found demand for more and more valuable medals being put in the covers of books.
Wow. I did not know about that history in books. Well, there is so much that we could talk about in terms of bookbinding. I know that you utilize many different stitches and edgings, is that correct?
There are a lot of stitches. There are as many ways to sew a book as there are people who sew them.
Nice.
But I really, I prefer a stitch called the link stitch. And the reason I like it is because it's called a flat stitch and it allows the book to lay open without fighting it at any page. So, you know, when you get a book from the library and you're reading it and your thumb gets tired because you're just fighting the spine to hold the book open.
Yes.
I build books that people write in and draw in, and they don't want to fight the spine in order to do that. So I build books that lay open easily at any page.
Yeah, that's I love that. You don't have to put that energy into holding the book open. You can just enjoy.
Right. But that means that like those books, the reason library books are hard to hold open is because it's expedient, right? I mean, machines sew those books and they can sew them out of flat sheets of paper, which is also a great benefit for people building books in a factory. But every one of my books is absolutely hand sewn using a needle and thread. And my mother, you know, rest her soul, would just croak if she could see me sewing, because she tried so hard to teach me to sew fabric. And I would always poke myself and leave a bunch of DNA on it to get out and get to go play again. it's kind of amazing that I sew pristine white paper and I don't poke my fingers and make a mess on it.
Well, she must love that, you know? Well, Ray, I really appreciate you spending some time with us and talking about what you're up to. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Ray Peterson is the owner of High Class Booker. We spoke to her in February. It's Pop of Culture. We are outside today, and I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Michelle Kinsey, enjoying the sunshine. It's time to ask another artist, what are you working on, aside from a tan?
Lynette Weitzel is a Midwestern mixed media artist. She's a talented graphic designer, illustrator, and visual communicator. She's inspired by all sorts of ephemera and objects, and I really want to thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. I'm going to ask you our question that we love to ask artists. What are you working on?
I wish I could say I was working on a lot more than I am. 2020 really took me into a down spiral, but I am getting back on the horse, if you will.
Good.
I'm working on some bigger mixed media pieces. As of recently, I've been taking on more feminine type pieces, feminist, if you will. And when I say that, I don't like, you know, I don't assume folks think I'm being one of those men haters, if you will. But it, more about how our roles in society shape us and what our expectations are. And so I have a couple pieces that I'm working on. One is called Aloof, A-L-O-O-F, and one is called Apathy. And they're same size. They could be a diptych, but they're not intended to be necessarily. And funny enough, I am using birth control pills on them, which is new for me. I do use a lot of found objects. And I had some old of the placebo pills and glued those on there. They just look like dots. But yeah, there's a little statement there.
Yeah. Well, can you talk to, you said it might be perceived or could be perceived as a diptych, which are two pieces that speak to each other, connected. Can you talk a little bit about a little bit more about what they look like and your process in making them?
Yeah, both. So I utilize a lot of old photos. The reason why I started that is I did a painting of my grandmother and actually used the photos and really upset my mother at one point in time. She was like, those are the only prints I had. So after that, I started looking for old photos in flea markets and antique shops. And so all of my work recently, my mixed media work, has kind of a kiss back to black and white photography. And on both of these pieces, the women look a little defeated. One lady has her hand on her chin, looks a little exhausted, and the other lady is laying down. Well, not really laying down, but she's laid her head down on a table, just like she's a little defeated or a little tired, maybe. And so there's some exhaustion there with both of these pieces.
Well, I would look forward to seeing those. And you brought a couple of pieces into the studio. And I would like you to talk a little bit about the one that's in a secretarial box.
Yeah.
Because it's also got some themes about women.
Yes. Yes. So the one that's in the secretarial box is called Pick Un, as in U-N, any un. So a play on Pick One, Anyone. And it is a secretarial box, one of those old wooden boxes that used to sit on secretaries' desks that they would put your to-do list in or things that needed filed or whatnot. But instead, I've used that as a frame in order to put a narrative, a visual narrative inside. And there's a chained piece that has a translucent old photograph of a little girl. And behind it has a lot of pieces of a dictionary that start with the letter U-N, all of the un words. And the dictionary. The sides of them also have gel medium that I have adhered dictionary pages. And all of the un words that are not flattering are circled. So there's like, let me look real quick because I want to. I don't have my glasses on, but like unquestionable, unworthy, unreal. All of these are circled. Unreasonable, unruly. And so you get the idea of what I'm saying here because I have a pattern, like a lady's pattern if you were a seamstress. There's also, it's a lot of cracked background. It has a little bitty coin purse and a large glass vase in it that is empty. And so this piece is ultimately about how as very small children we are born without knowing what people think about us until we get older. And so these unwords are sometimes, for women, I believe, put upon us either in other terminology, but it's easy for women to go, oh, this is really what they mean. So if it's, instead of being adamant, you know, it's unreasonable. You know, and so I found these unwords in the dictionary and I thought, yeah, there's something about that with women and the way that we are spoke about or, you know, unruly wouldn't be, you know, you wouldn't call a boy unruly usually.
You would, or if you did, it would be just fine.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But a boy is more like rambunctious, you know, they're just, they're eager, you know, and, and so it was a little play on how women, and then not only how maybe we have been called these words in some way, shape or form, but how we interpret them. We might not have thought that we were, like, they may not have said we were unruly, but maybe someone used rambunctious with us, and then we interpret it as unruly because a lot of women think and rethink and go down that hole. And yeah, art is based on your experiences, and I do have one of those minds that tend to go into loops, and so there's a little bit of my experiences in there.
Oh, well, I really appreciate you sharing that with us. And Lynn, I must say, I saw your work recently at the 35th Annual Miniaturista Exhibition, and you draw these stories. It looks like a sociological dig, the one that's on the wall right now. You do collage, assemblage, sculptures with shadow boxes, painting. And this piece that is at Miniaturista right now, all these stories kept flooding through my head. So can you talk about that piece a little bit?
Yeah.
And what it means to you?
Yeah. That piece also has another black and white photo that I've worked into what I call a digital transfer. But the image at Miniaturista is about taking orders. They're about us being order takers. And it is a actual image of probably more of a worker of the earth, more of a farmer or farm hand, if you will, with her two small children digging into the ground and trying to find the fruitfulness that they are in the middle of this hot sun. And so it's like taking orders to do things that aren't necessarily the most comfortable, but yet gaining fruit from that. So the hard work that it takes to come out on the other end for that fruitfulness, if that makes sense.
It definitely makes sense. That's pretty inspiring. Thought.
Thanks.
You know, well, I appreciate you sharing with us today. Yeah. And I would also like you to tell everybody where they can see your work.
Currently, it is at Miniaturista right now. You can go to lynettewhitesell.com. So it's LYNETTE, spelled WHITESELL.com. I am working on a piece that will hopefully be in the downtown steamroller event that's coming up. Which is going to be work that's completely different than most of the stuff I do. But I don't have any upcoming shows. I've had some conversations with a few folks, and I've just kind of been playing it low since 2020, but I'm ready to get back to work again.
It sounds like you're on the upward trajectory. Yeah, I think a lot of people are. A lot of artists are coming out of hibernation.
Yes, it feels like that very much.
Well, thank you so much for sharing with us today, Lynn.
Thank you again for having me.
It's time for the arts calendar.
It is.
All right.
Why don't you kick us off, Kara?
I will.
May 2nd is First Friday in Anderson. This is a special one because there will be an unveiling of Anderson's Artist Alley, showcasing new works from 10 artists that will be featured during 2025. The event is 5 to 8 p.m.
Oh, if you have not gone to the alley, how fun is that? I love walking down the alley and seeing all of the artwork displayed on the walls. What a creative use of space.
Yes.
Love it. The 25th anniversary screening of Ed Ball's Century is Friday, May 2nd at Minnetrista Museum and Gardens. The locally produced documentary, which chronicles the extraordinary life of a Muncie industrialist and philanthropist, Edmund F. Ball, will begin at 7 p.m. Executive producer Nancy Carlson will be there to share some behind-the-scenes info about the documentary and check out episode 16 of Pop of Culture for our interview with Nancy.
That's going to be great.
Mm-hmm.
The Youth Symphony Orchestra will have a concert at 3 p.m. Sunday, May 4th at Sursa Performance Hall at Ball State. This concert will feature the Suzuki Class for 5 and 6-year-olds, the Prelude Orchestra, Overture Strings, and Intermezzo Orchestra, and the Youth Symphony Orchestra. Founded in 1964, the Youth Symphony Orchestra of East Central Indiana brings together young musicians from Delaware County and surrounding communities to provide weekly orchestra experiences.
If you have not seen the 5 and 6-year-olds, the Suzuki Class, it's delightful. Like the violins that they use are like bigger than their entire bodies. It's fantastic. I love it. Love that concert. Excellent. A Dr. Demento tribute performance is set for 7 p.m. Saturday at the historic Farmland USA and Farmland Community Center. The cast will present several silly musical numbers, including Shaving Cream.
Juneteenth Muncie will present a Representation Matters event at 3 p.m. Sunday at Community of Hope. The event will include a youth-focused career options fair, the Devin Carter Jr. Youth Innovation Award, and the Future Story Photo Booth. The Future Story Photo Booth is available for kids in kindergarten through 12th grade who want to dress up as the person they want to be when they grow up.
Adorable. It's so cool to see the different careers represented. I love that. And finally, May the 4th be with you. Anderson's Paramount Theater will be celebrating Star Wars Day on May 4th with screenings of the first three original Star Wars films, A New Hope, The Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi. They'll be showing those back to back. For more information, go to andersonparamount.org. Fun it will be.
Forever Star Wars.
Yes.
If you have a far out event Pop of Culture listeners need to know about, tell us at indianapublicradio.org/contact, then click Pop of Culture.
Skadoosh.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
And that's our show. Our Director of Audio Operations is Sean Ashcraft, and our producer is Luke Jones, who's been looking through stained glass, or maybe smudged glass, since the second grade. Our show was hosted by me, Michelle Kinsey.
And me, Kara Duquette. Pop of Culture is a production of IPR on the campus of Ball State University.
Nice.
Okay, I didn't know if this outdoor format, you'd be like, okay, and then we start the next one, or if we were just going. Okay.
Nope, I'll still say okay.
Cool.
That's you.
Oh, that was the okay.
Yeah.